Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And we'll begin with our meds, their costs, and our safety. Of all the people on this planet, Americans spend the most on prescription drugs, and the costs of those medicines are not expected to stop rising anytime soon. The idea of importing drugs from Canada to help bring down those prices is being floated in Congress. And according to a 2019 Kaiser Family Foundation survey, 80% of Americans like that idea. Consumer advocates have argued that importation would help cut those costs. Opponents, however, are concerned about the safety of imported drugs. In this segment, we're focusing on those safety concerns. Shabir Imber Safdar is executive director of the Partnership for Safe Medicines, a not-for-profit that researches the dangers of counterfeit drugs in this country and educates us about how to make sure we keep them out of our medicine cabinets. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Shabir.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And first, how big is this? How prevalent are these fake drugs in this country?
Well, we have been tracking just fake pills made with fentanyl, which is a small subset of a larger fake drug problem. And we have found them in every single state. And we found deaths that have been confirmed by toxicology and coroner's reports in every single state, including Kentucky. If you look at 2021, you had over 2,100 people die of drug-related deaths, drug-related overdoses and poisonings, as we call them, in 2021 in just the state of Kentucky, and it's being driven by fentanyl and fake pills.
Do you have an example, a story of something that's happened here in Kentucky related to these fentanyl-laced drugs?
I mean, the Fayette County Health Department has been working hard on just trying to keep enough Narcan in stock. It's actually a problem in every part of Kentucky, but also in the whole country. Mm-hmm. There's so many of these deaths happening that it's almost impossible to keep it in stock between first responders and others. But any one of the 2,100 deaths in Kentucky last year, each one had a family and an extended family that it affected. And it's 15% higher than 2020. We have not seen the bottom of this crisis either in Kentucky or in this country yet.
So are these counterfeit prescription drugs that people are taking inadvertently, unknowingly?
There's actually three kinds of counterfeits that affect people in the U.S. and in Kentucky. There's fake pills made with fentanyl, which is what is driving a lot of the deaths in Kentucky, but also illicit drugs like heroin and cocaine that have been laced with fentanyl because it's a cheap additive that adds to its oomph. Then there's also fake medicines like blood thinners that people order off of websites or they go to Mexico and get from cheap border pharmacies that have absolutely no active ingredient. And if you take those for a month or two, you'll end up with blood clots and strokes, which is also a risk.
Is there a concern when you're online ordering through an organization like Express Scripts that you might wind up with these?
So when you go online to buy medicine, you always want to go to a pharmacy that's licensed by the Kentucky Board of Pharmacy. Express Scripts is license, so it's safe. But there's lots of people who think that they're going to get a great deal if they go to a website with a Canadian flag graphic on it. And not only are those not actual pharmacies in the U.S. or in Kentucky, but they're not even real pharmacies in Canada. They're often just vendors who were shipping medicine that has been made overseas in dirty labs from places like Turkey into the U.S. and pretending to be pharmacies. And of course, there's no way to prosecute them if they hurt you, which is the worst part.
Well, there's been a lot of reporting around fentanyl and what it can do to you. But just to revisit that for the moment, the risk of taking these pills instead of the real thing might seem obvious, but what is it about these pills laced with fentanyl that makes them especially dangerous?
Well, the danger is in the manufacturing inconsistency, right? When you're a Mexican cartel making pills or you're someone actually pressing them in your garage with a pill press you bought off the internet, the difference between killing a customer and getting a customer high is like a grain of salt. That's how much the difference in fentanyl is between death and not death. And so they get it wrong a lot. And those pills have a tendency to kill people who take them, sometimes even before they've been addicted. We've got a number of examples, like Alexander Neville is a young man out of California. I work with his family. And, you know, he, one of the first pills he took actually just killed him. And his mom said, I didn't even have time to deal with the questions of addiction. So you really have to be careful. The only safe medicine you can get these days is from a pharmacy or a hospital.
I understand from your literature that it can be difficult to detect fentanyl in a drug, that there are lots of variations out there. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So fentanyl is a very versatile molecule, and it has at least 2,000 alternate versions, not all of which will get you high, but many of which do. And so chemists trying to evade legal prosecution will make changes to the molecule, adding a little oxygen here, a little carbon there, in order to try and take something that was scheduled as an illegal drug and make it legal. And some of them are actually even more potent. Some of them are so potent that even what would fit on the head of a pencil becomes actually a fatal dose. So that is a factor. And then also there are new pills being made that have non-fentanyl molecules that will get you high that don't respond to Narcan. Those are really quite dangerous because even if an EMT finds you, they can't save you.
Well, how are these drugs getting into the country?
So you will find fake sources. They'll either come from Mexico or Canada from criminal gangs who smuggle them over the border. There are, in fact, several gangs in Canada, even though the country seems like a very friendly place, that are making these pills and shipping them to the U.S. Or people will make them in a garage. They'll buy fentanyl in raw form from a drug dealer, and then they'll buy a pill press and they'll make their own pills in their garage. And all of that, of course, is very dangerous.
What are the demographics, Shabir? Is a particular age group targeted, or is this hitting Americans across the board, regardless of age?
It's pretty much hitting Americans across the board. You know, we've seen a lot of demand spike since the opioid crisis has caused prescribing of opioids to drop. So the black market has filled the void. But what we've seen lately is a drive to drug traffickers to use social media to advertise their pills. Literally, they'll post pictures of pills. And because social media's user base is young, we're starting to see a very heavy rise in teen deaths because teens use social media. So teens on Snapchat, teens on TikTok and Instagram, they're all seeing these drug dealers post their photos of their pills and then messaging them to set up purchases. And they're often fatal.
Your position is that there are prescription drug importation proposals that could, in the end, just make things worse. Tell us about that.
Well, we have just lived through a pandemic in which we experienced what it was like to deal with shortages of N95 masks and a globe full of criminals who were happy to sell us fake versions of that. And what we learned from that experience is twofold, one of which is people don't care. They will sell you anything to make a buck, regardless of how it endangers you. And that it's very hard to prosecute them. Very few foreign sellers of medical products during the pandemic that were counterfeit have been brought to justice in the U.S. And so I can tell you from having studied this for 20 years, there's a very evolved global criminal network of people that make fake pills, and they would like nothing more to break into the U.S. market. So, for example, earlier last month, when Senator Paul voted in favor of opening the drug supply to importers from Latvia and Turkey, I had a slight panic attack because I know those countries are full of counterfeiters, and Senator Paul's insistence on dismantling consumer protections had me really worried.
Is there any room for some sort of compromise that would, on the one hand, allow at least some tightly regulated and monitored importation to chip away at that cost problem while, on the other hand, keeping us safe? Is that even possible?
Well, not really. If you actually delve into this policy, the Canadians are not going to cooperate with us. They have different problems about shortages in their drug supply, and they are not interested in shipping us any of their medicine. They will do everything they can to stop it. The thing that we need to do is to regulate these middlemen, the pharmacy benefit managers who are driving up prices of medicine for health insurance companies and patients and then pocketing the profit. Once we get a handle on them, I think that we'll be able to actually see some savings for consumers.
What do we need to do, individuals, to make sure that these drugs don't wind up in our medicine cabinets? And is that a concern, or is it more about illicit drugs that are laced with fentanyl?
It's both. And for people of my age, and, you know, I'm in my 50s and I've got both teenagers and elderly parents, there's two conversations you have to have. With your teenagers, as I have had with mine, you need to talk to them about the existence of deadly fake pills, that even sometimes breaking a pill in half and taking it if it came from an unsafe source could be a fatal event. Our kids cannot make good decisions if we don't tell them about the danger. So that's what I do. I talk to my kids about those dangers, knowing that they're going to have to make a decision out of my presence and hoping that if they know the fact that they're going to be safer. With my parents, I talk to them about where is a safe place to get medication. Is that website really the website of a licensed pharmacy in the state of Kentucky, or is it someplace foreign that has no pharmacy license at all? And if it doesn't have a pharmacy license, it's not safe. And I can help them check, right? I can sit with them at the computer and I can help them look up on the Kentucky Board of Pharmacy website to see if a website is really safe or not.
And speaking of websites, you have a ton of information on yours. Can you give us that web address?
Absolutely. You can find lots of information about the counterfeit medicine problem in America and how to find safe websites at www.safemedicines.org.
That's Shabir Imber Safdar, Executive Director of the Partnership for Safe Medicines. Thank you so much, Shabir.
Thank you.
The latest data from the Centers for Disease Control tell us that overdose deaths are higher than deaths for HIV, car crashes, or gun violence at their peaks. The data also show that the increased deaths correspond strongly with the use of synthetic opioids known as fentanyls. A new book from a Kentucky novelist draws on Shakespeare to capture the ravages of drug addiction in eastern Kentucky. Here's Tom Eblen with another installment in our series highlighting the works of Kentucky authors.
Heather Henson was born in Danville and grew up at Pioneer Playhouse, Kentucky's oldest outdoor theater. Her father, Eben Henson, founded the theater in 1950, and Heather now runs it. But she also has an award-winning sideline as an author of books for young readers. After earning a degree in creative writing from the New School in New York City, Henson took a job as a temp in the children's division of the publisher HarperCollins. She found a calling there, and over the next decade advanced from editorial assistant to senior editor. Then she left to write her own books. Henson has written 9 books for young readers so far, and all of them are set in Kentucky. Many tell stories of famous Kentuckians whose contributions have been all but forgotten, such as Stephen Bishop, the enslaved tour guide at Mammoth Cave, who was internationally famous in his day, or the women of the Frontier Nursing Service, who a century ago were riding horses into Leslie County's hollers to deliver babies, and the book women, who in the 1930s brought books on horseback to poor families living in remote eastern Kentucky mountains. Henson's newest book is Wrecked, a novel for young adults, but rather than Kentucky history, it deals with some grittier issues of the present, including family secrets, the difficulties of first loves, and methamphetamine addiction. Here to talk with us about Wrecked is author Heather Henson. Heather, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, tell us a little about the story you tell in Wrecked.
I had long been interested in the play The Tempest because I grew up in the world of theater, and so I gravitate toward theater and plays and Shakespeare. And in one of my earlier books, The Tempest played a huge part in that book. And I had, from that time on, been interested in taking the framework, the basic story of a father and daughter stranded on a deserted island, and doing something new with it, taking it and making it a modern framework. So that's what I did with Wrecked. So on one level, it's a retelling of Shakespeare's The Tempest. On another level, it's a coming-of-age story about first love and, as you said, secrets, and about a kind of gritty underbelly in my home state of Kentucky, meth addiction and abuse.
Mm-hmm. So what was it you wanted to say about meth addiction and abuse that you thought would appeal to young readers and help kind of relate to them?
Well, I never believe, I've been writing for young readers for 20 years, and actually in the business for that long, since I worked as an editor before I began writing my own books. And I really feel strongly that you don't talk down, you don't write down to young readers. Teens know a lot, they're dealing with a lot, and so I like to speak to them, you know, on their own level. And I feel like there's a lot happening right now. I personally have known many people whose children, whose brothers, whose sisters have died of overdose, meth, oxy, heroin. It's become something that's an everyday occurrence in my part of the world, in Kentucky. And so I kind of wanted to write about that and, again, use the framework of Shakespeare, iconic story, because I was interested in that, but take it to a real place and things that are happening right now in Kentucky.
You tell the story in kind of short chapters that are told in the voice of three main characters, Miri, Finn, and Clay. Tell us a little about them and kind of what their world's about.
I decided to set it in the Knobs of Kentucky. All of my books have been set in Kentucky, and I felt that the Knobs were kind of a parallel to the Shakespearean world, which, you know, The Tempest is set on a deserted island. The Knobs are certainly not surrounded by water. It's land that surrounds these three characters, but they are isolated from the rest of the world. So I felt that that was a great place to put it. Miri is Miranda in The Tempest. Finn is Ferdinand, the first man she's ever seen, and the first person she falls in love with, love at first sight. And Clay is Caliban, who in the play definitely is a character who is a fairly dark character, but I thought it would be interesting to take a character that makes bad decisions and is not always a likable character and kind of get into his head and under his skin. So again, this is The Tempest in a way was a jumping off point. This is not a complete retelling. It's almost more of a reimagining. And when you see The Tempest, you're focused on Prospero, the father, the adults in the book, in the play. But I felt like I wanted to take a look at the teenagers, Miranda, Miri, and say, what would it feel like to have been stranded on an island with your father for 13 years? What would it feel like for your father to have developed these magic powers and suddenly announced to you that he's a wizard and that actually you're a noble woman from another country and you were banished from your home because of something that Prospero did in his past? And, you know, all of this stuff is revealed to Miranda in the first part of the play. And so I wanted to take that kind of idea and make it into a young adult novel.
Mm-hmm. What do you hope your readers will take from the book?
Well, for one thing, I mean, I'm kind of a Shakespeare nerd. Like, I loved Shakespeare when I was a teenager. I do know that Shakespeare is still taught, but it's not taught as frequently or as maybe as hard in high schools these days, because I do have teenagers myself. And I kind of would love teenagers to go back and read Shakespeare and kind of have a new way of looking at it. But I also want teenagers to feel like they're seeing themselves in the pages of my book. I think Miri's dilemma of having family secrets, of having a father who is doing questionable things, I think that's something that kids can relate to these days. Finn has suddenly moved to Kentucky from Detroit. I think a lot of kids can relate to being a fish out of water. And Clay, Clay ended up being my favorite character to write. And, you know, I think he has so many things on his side, but he has trouble dealing with the outside world. And again, he makes kind of questionable choices. And I think I like writing characters that are a little difficult.
Well, one thing I liked about the book was that it even if you didn't know the Shakespeare background, mm-hmm. it really seemed like, you know, kind of a very contemporary tale of Appalachian children, you know, growing up with a lot of the kind of the poverty and the whole drug issues. And mm-hmm. how do you think that these circumstances are going to shape this generation of Appalachian young people?
I think it's a tough time to be growing up here in Kentucky and Appalachia. I'm not going to lie. I think there are tough times ahead. And I hope that kids would read this and find hope. You know, in this book, there is a hopeful ending. I think it shows kids that, you know, there's an outside world other than what they may be experiencing in their own home. You know, when I was writing this book, there were so many articles in the newspapers about meth houses being raided and kids being taken from their parents. I was just struck by it because a lot of people think, well, meth was way back in the 80s or 90s. It's not a new drug. It actually has had a resurgence because it's a very inexpensive way to get high if you can't get opioids anymore. And so it really had quite a big resurgence in the last few years. And I became kind of fascinated by that. And when I was thinking of what was the equivalent in modern day to the magic that Prospero would have developed over the over time in his island. I don't know. It just came to me, meth. But it's a hard time, and I think we need to really support programs that help with addiction and not just treat it as, you know, arrest people for it. We need to really look at the root of the problem and help people.
Well, what are you working on next? What kind of a book?
You know, I went back to my roots of YA. My first novel that I published was a young adult, and so I've come full circle 20 years later to young adult. And I think I'm still on that track. I really am liking the writing for that age group. I like short, sharp sentences and quick chapters. That's kind of my style. So I'm working on a book right now, another young adult, about a campground and a group of kids who are basically homeless but living in a campground, because I've actually personally seen that where I'm living, that more and more people are buying campers and RVs because they've been displaced from their jobs or their homes, and they're finding alternative ways to live.
Yeah, well, that sounds interesting. Well, as I mentioned, you have a day job, running Pioneer Playhouse. How are things going there?
I call it wearing many hats. I have to put on one hat, take off the other hat. Yeah. Pioneer Playhouse, my dad started in 1950, and we have been going. This is our 73rd year in the Bluegrass. It's been a family-run business. We lost my dad in 2004. We lost my sister 10 years ago. But my brother, Robbie Henson, and my mother, Charlotte Henson, and I are keeping it going, and it's going great. We're having a lot of support. We're doing 3 shows this summer. And if you've never been to Pioneer Playhouse in Danville, it's a unique experience. I really think everyone should come out and check us out.
Okay, well, thanks very much. And once again, the book is Wrecked, a novel for young adults by Heather Henson. Thanks, Heather, for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
For Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin.
Coming up after the break, why Knox County Middle is one of only 4 in the state to win Bright Spot recognition.
The staff I had at Knox County Middle School is what truly made it happen. They were eager to show that our students can do the same thing that other students in Kentucky can do.
And Pikeville gets ready for the Mountain Girl Experience.
Appalachian women helping Appalachian women.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Hicks & Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Mitch Whitaker provide legal representation for car and truck accidents and other personal injury matters. More information at 859-777-7000. Major support for WEKU comes from Kentucky's Touchstone Energy Cooperatives, supplying reliable power to co-op members across the state. Co-ops are proud to support Ronald McDonald House in Kentucky through sponsorship and volunteerism. More info at www.togetherwesaveky.com. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Out of the more than 400 middle schools across Kentucky, only 4 have qualified as Bright Spot schools, public schools that have performed better than expected on measures of educational achievement analyzed by the Center for Business and Economic Research at UK in partnership with the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. Knox County Middle was one of those 4 schools, and we wanted to find out what they're getting right in Knox County. Knox County, population about 31,000, is located in southeast Kentucky, near the borders with Tennessee and Virginia. The highest paying jobs in the county are in mining, quarrying, and oil and gas extraction. Barberville is the county seat. Here with us is Knox County Superintendent of Schools, Jeremy Ledford. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jeremy.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
And as I understand that you had quite an interruption, as did all the other schools in Kentucky, by the pandemic, that kind of set you back a little bit. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Whenever we started this process of reteaching in Panther time, it was before the pandemic. So we were able to stay on schedule, and kids really knew what was going on with our schools. So with the pandemic, it kind of caused quite a bit of disruption, but hopefully we're back on the right track.
Okay, well, we'll talk about those things then in anticipation of next fall being a regular fall, knock on wood. And congratulations on this recognition, by the way.
Thank you. Our staff and students, it's been really exciting for Knox County students.
In a press release about it, the Pritchard Committee's Bridget Blom says, and I'm going to quote her here, this 425-student school where 86% of students are considered economically disadvantaged adopted a no-excuses mentality to eliminate failure and outperform expectations, end quote. That sounds like quite a tall order. Being economically disadvantaged implies all sorts of plausible excuses for underperformance. How did you all overcome that?
Well, I just want to begin by saying that the staff I had at Knox County Middle School is what truly made it happen. They were eager to show that our students can do the same thing that other students in Kentucky can do. And I began as principal there. We were in the bottom 19% in the state. And I attended NISL, which is the National Institute of School Leaders, and my first year, Todd Tucker and Susan Greer taught the class, and they were instrumental in really helping me refine my plan of reteaching. Our goal for our school was a three-year goal to just be proficient. We became a school of distinction instead in 3 years. We actually missed the proficiency by, I think, like a half a point after that first year. But our staff worked hard to create this system that would truly help kids, and this model gave students two opportunities to master the content before they had to stay after school. So what we did was, on their own in regular class, they had to make above a 70% on that core content standard. If they didn't master the content with a 70%, they had to go to a reteaching class. Now, all of our classes were 55 minutes, and we wanted students to understand that reteaching was just as important as their regular core content class because that's what they were being retaught. So they would go to that class if they didn't make above a 70%. Then they would spend that week going over that standard, and then they would take a test on that standard. If they made above a 70%, they was out of reteaching, and then we changed their grade to reflect that new score. And then they were able to go back to an enrichment class with their peers. The first time they took the test in class, the second time was in reteaching. Well, if they didn't make above that 70% that second time, then they had to go to mandatory tutoring after school. And once they passed above, which was on Tuesdays and Thursdays, but once they passed that with a 70% or above, then they were out of tutoring after school. They didn't have to go back. And what we realized really quickly is that once students was held accountable for their learning, they worked really hard not to have to go to reteaching and Panther time. They didn't want to go during school, and they didn't want to go after school. They wanted to go to enrichment and learn Spanish, engineering, PE, whatever it may be, and be with their friends. So students started working very hard to really bridge those gaps that maybe that they had. And we've seen, you know, after school tutoring that first time, we had probably 80 kids. After the first month of tutoring, it was about 15 to 20 kids, which is what it should be.
Well, it sounds to me as though what you've done here is make it so that the perception of reteaching is not as a punishment, but as a way to get something that a student needs.
Yeah, it was not popular at the beginning by no means with parents. You know, the concept of students having to stay after school to do the same work that they should do in class. Well, we were given that opportunity, and that's what we explained to parents, is that we were giving them two opportunities to do it during the school day, but they still wasn't mastering it, so we wanted them to be successful, and the only way for them to be successful was to get more time after school because we still had to move forward, you know, with the content. So we also provided transportation. Our district was very fortunate to give me, I was really excited that they gave us buses to take kids home after school if they had to stay. We really wanted to bridge that gap.
That's got to make a huge difference.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and like I said at the beginning, you know, having 80 to 100 kids was very difficult. But once kids started really working hard and that number was cut back to 15 or 20 kids as all the kids that we had. And those were kids that truly had a learning gap. So it wasn't popular at the beginning, but how we showed students and parents that the work was valued and not punishment is by changing the students' grades when they had mastered the standards.
So parents have kind of, they've come around to this?
Yes. Yeah. After my first year with this concept, I really had no issues after that. I mean, if a student had a doctor's excuse or something like that, we didn't care. They just had to come the next day. I mean, we wanted them to be successful. It wasn't punishment. We just wanted them to make sure that they knew the standard so their grades would reflect the mastery of that content. And those kids worked hard. And the next set of standards became easier for them because they were able to build on what they already knew. So students was now held accountable for their own learning, and students really prospered. The gaps closed for them and became successful. And as we all know, success, kind of creates success. And the numbers really dropped, and our school scores went up, and students mastered the content.
I see you have something called Panther Time. You mentioned that in the earlier in the interview. What is that?
The Panther Time is the reteaching time, and we just called it Panther Time because that was our mascot.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And so no one really likes to say, well, it's reteaching, so we just called it Panther Time because we were Panthers, and it was time for them to learn that specific content.
So is the process of tweaking and refining ongoing? Are you constantly making adjustments?
That is week to week and day to day. Teachers are very tuned into their kids that they have with. We have a team concept at the middle school. So you have 7 blue, 7 gold, 8 blue, 8 gold, and they have those kids all day with their content. So they know what kid is getting it. They know what kid isn't. And so they may place a kid that's not getting it in reteaching class, and they may only be there for 2 days if they haven't failed a common assessment or, a quiz. So they're able to catch them up immediately to where they're not having to stay for reteaching. I mean, the ultimate goal is for no one to be in reteaching, but we have to really close that gap, which is what we're trying to do on a larger scale within the county with a common curriculum pacing guides.
Now, I know that you're working to adopt common curriculum pacing plans at the 7 elementary schools in the Knox County District. How does that work?
One of the biggest misconceptions is that we're wanting teachers to teach all the same way, and that's just not true. What we're wanting is teachers to teach the same standard at the same time period. We don't ask teachers to teach the same way. We all know that all teachers have their own teaching style. We just want kids in our district to learn the same material at the same time. And it's important because we have a lot of transient students that move from one school to the next. So to give an example, let's say that I'm a social studies teacher at maybe Lay Elementary, and I start with economics at my elementary school, but at G.R. Hampton, that teacher may start with government. Then let's say that student or one of their students switch from one school to the next. They will never get that content because it's already been taught. So what we're trying to do is to align our standards to where every school in our district is teaching that content standard. Now, there's no way for everyone to be on every single day exactly the same, but it's a whole lot better to be off maybe 1 week than to be off a month. So this is going to allow, if our students move from one school to the next, they will have very little instruction that they've missed on a content standard.
Well, Superintendent Ledford, I have to believe that it must have been mighty gratifying, maybe validating, to receive this Bright Spot recognition.
Yes, we were so excited, and I've heard nothing but great things from our teachers and principals and our community. And I really do appreciate that you spotlighted our students here in Knox County.
Well, and I understand that you even have a teacher by the name of Miracle.
Yes, Miss Miracle is a 7th grade math teacher.
Seems appropriate. Jeremy Ledford, Superintendent of Schools in Knox County, Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and I appreciate you having me, Alan.
Rolling in my sweet baby's arms. They're gonna lay
That's Rollin' in My Sweet Baby's Arms. It's a track from the album of fresh-picked Kentucky tunes due later this summer from the Corn Maze String Band, featuring Yanni Vozos, Zoe Barrett, Arlo Barnett, guest musician Adam Hurt, and with us online, Carla Gover. Hi, Carla.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great. And so you have a new album on the way, all original, or are there some choice covers in that mix as well?
Well, actually, it's neither is quite correct. mostly it's traditional tunes from Appalachia. We have a couple of originals on there, and then we have one unexpected cover.
Unexpected cover? That sounds mysterious. What was that?
Well, I say it's unexpected because we are a traditional Appalachian old-time string band, but we covered a Peter Gabriel song, Salisbury Hill.
Oh, all right. I see Bath County Boy in the lineup of tunes. I'm from Round County, so that strikes a bell here. And you all have one of those in your band, Arlo Barnett. Is this by or about Arlo?
Yes. So we got our Arlo when my daughter brought him home from music camp when she was in ninth grade. And he's an amazing musician, and now he is my son-in-law. They've been together almost 10 years. And when they got married, I wanted to give them a special gift. So I wrote the song for their wedding.
Oh, that's really cool. Let's listen to a sampling of Bath County Boy.
Okay.
Is a gift quite rare, so feed her milk and honey in the morning. Bath County boy, tall as a tree, better take her home and happy you'll be. Feed her whole cakes and venison and sassafras tea, never wake her early in the morning.
So that was Bath County Boy. It's from the new album coming from the Corn Maze String Band, and online with us to talk about it is Carla Gover. Carla, you all are doing all this on your own, the marketing, the sales, the distribution. Is that an easier lift today than, say, 15, 20 years ago, thanks to technology? Do you have more tools at your disposal?
Well, we certainly have more tools. I'd say yes, in general, it is easier. The only thing that's different than when I started doing this, I did my first crowd-funded album before there was even internet, using snail mail in 1998 or 99. And the one big difference back then is that everybody was still buying a lot of CDs. So that was a really big assistance in the pocketbook in terms of getting your music out there, because you could pre-sell them or you could just sell them at shows. And that was a really significant chunk of income. And so we've had to really adapt to find models and ways of earning money for our art that don't include too many physical CD sales. Now, we still have some diehards that buy them, but in terms of, you know, having social media platforms and email lists and ways to do graphic design on our own, yes, there's a lot of options.
Has it been kind of hard to completely step away from CDs?
Yeah, I don't think you can completely step away from them, especially in a demographic like ours. We're playing traditional music, and you know, there are some listeners from the generation that just got used to buying a physical product who still want to have that in their hand and read some liner notes and whatnot. So yeah, we still do them, but we also sell a lot of downloads digitally.
Well, I see on your schedule that in July you're soloing at something called Mountain Girl Experience. What's that about? Where's that happening?
Well, this is the first time that I will have performed there, but it's an event in Pike County, and there are just a ton, kind of focuses on female musicians and dancers and artists and artisans from Appalachia. And I think it's just about empowerment and uplifting Appalachian voices, female voices. So I'm excited to do that. My daughter, Maisie, who is not in this band, is actually going to perform there with me. So that's pretty cool.
And then in August, Serbia? How did you land a gig in Serbia?
Well, a lot of these international gigs are coming because Zoe and Arlo and I traveled to a conference in Florida and showcased, and there were a lot of international presenters and we just did a lot of meet and greets. That was something that was partially funded by an organization called South Arts, which is a really cool organization supporting Southern artists. And we have just kept in contact and kept in conversation with a lot of these different festivals. And as it worked out, it's just all happening this year. Some of it was supposed to occur during the COVID shutdowns and we had to postpone. And then the Serbia just kind of came in. The other really cool thing is that Yanni and I have been able to write some grants to Mid-Atlantic Arts Foundation and the Trust for Mutual Understanding. And those are two organizations that help foster artists from the United States to travel internationally to festivals and things.
I'm going to want to hear about that trip when you get back. Would you mind giving us a call?
Yeah, I'm so excited. I'm sure we'll want to talk about it and post about it and share.
Sure. Well, how can we find out more about the Coram Mays String Band?
Well, there's two good ways. I keep all of our show dates on our website, which is Coram Mays, that's M-A-I-Z, CoramMaysStringBand.com. But also, to be honest with you, I send out a lot of emails and updates through my personal website about Coram Mays and just everything I do. So if listeners want to go to CarlaGover.com, I send out a free Mountain Mama digital care package with music and my granny's cornbread recipe and a little video teaching you how to flat foot and clog. It's really fun, and it's just a fun way to stay connected with people. So I just encourage everybody to go there and sign up, and that way we can keep getting to know each other over the internet.
All right, that's Carla Gover. If you live in Eastern or Central Kentucky and you don't know that name, you need to. She's a great ambassador for all of us for the region. Thank you so much, Carla.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard Carla Gover mention performing at the Mountain Girl Experience happening in Pike County later this month. It's being put on by the City of Pikeville and the Appalachian Center for the Arts, where Robin Irwin is executive director, and she joins us from Pikeville. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Robin.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to talk to you again.
And first, if you would, give our listeners the details. When and where will the Mountain Girl Experience happen?
Great. It is July 22nd and 23rd in Pikeville, downtown Pikeville, at the Appalachian Center for the Arts. We have three performative stages. There's a big tent out back in our parking lot. Then our theater space will be the headline space for musicians and keynotes and whatnot, but also other workshops during both days, plus the galleries. We had many, many artists submit their work, so the sort of ersatz gallery is throughout. Plus, we do have our own gallery where there will be our Kentucky home, Hispanic Americans of the Commonwealth. That's a Kentucky Arts Council curated exhibit that is housed in there at that time. And then go down 2nd Street and encounter 30 vendors and food trucks and whatnot, all artisans and makers and really people who are making a difference in Appalachia. And you hit the Mountaintop Media stage on the Appalachian Wireless Pavilion. And that's a big outdoor space as well.
Well, it's called the Mountain Girl Experience, so it might seem obvious what it's about. But talk to us a little bit about the programming.
Well, the Mountain Girl, it came about really in 2021. The app and the city were very instrumental in having these creative community meetings. These on Zoom, we kept trying to gather together. But we couldn't. So we did them on Zoom, and they were facilitated by my husband and Ruthie Caldwell from Vision Granted. And we had breakout sessions and everything. And just to see what, for the community to have ownership and a voice in what is happening and what they want to see happen downtown artistically, you know? So we got talking, Chris Preston, who is the co-founder of this event, and I, and she was like, I've always dreamed of having a music and art festival, and I called like the Mountain Girl Festival, and I said, wow, that is fascinating. That's a perfect name. And she said, yeah. And so we just sort of dreamed, and I had her come by and come by the space, and we sat 6 feet apart, and we really sort of hashed out the first incarnation. We laugh about it now, but she was like, and we'll have all three stages, and we'll all be, and so, and this person and that person. I said, okay, let's scale it down and let's build it. And we are make this sustainable and awesome. And I was particularly perplexed at the same time by the numbers that were, I was hearing that domestic violence was on the rise, intimate partner violence of all kinds, stalking, menacing, physical, emotional, financial abuse mm-hmm. of all intimate partners. And no one was really talking about it at the water cooler level, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's like, this is a really significant public health crisis. In the middle of a public health crisis, it was just a concentric circle of crises. And I said, why don't we tie this to really helping women? And she said, Appalachian women helping Appalachian women. And that I said, that Chris was like, you got it. And that's really how Mountain Girl the first year was born. And Chris got we partnered with her. Chris is one of the founding members of the all-girl string band, Coal Town Dixie, named after the bassist's grandma, Grandma Dixie. They're a wonderful, preeminent group. And so we just started working on it. And I worked on the city logistics side and trying to get some talent and people and art. And, you know, it's the modern day equivalent of, well, my uncle's got a barn. let's put on a show.
How about the city of Pikeville? Are they? I know that they're co-sponsors, correct? And they're helping put it on.
Well, they're tourism. Yes, Pikeville tourism is moving and shaking, and obviously they're a co-sponsor of it. Yeah.
And so it's a 2-day festival. Do you expect overnight stays, and are there enough hotel rooms to accommodate?
We do. We do anticipate that, and you know, I don't know what the audience ancillary impact will be. I do know that last year, you know, based on my numbers, because I'm a numbers nerd, people from 9 states came in for this festival. Abby the Spoon Lady, I don't know if you know about her. She has a huge following on YouTube, and she walks with grace. That's all I can say. She if you don't know her, you should look her up on YouTube. She's coming, and she has a huge following. And people came from North Carolina, and they said, oh, my Lord, I saw that Abby the Spoon Lady was going to be here, and we came because of that. So don't say that art isn't impactful.
Well, let's have a little sampling of Abby the Spoon Lady. Proceeds from the festival support something?
Yes, the net proceeds from this festival go to Turning Point Domestic Violence Services and the Perry Klein Emergency Shelter. They were thrilled. Turning Point was not a recipient of any of the funds last year because we really didn't know about them, but Westcare Perry Klein was, and they are again.
Robin, when I last talked with you, the pandemic had slammed the arts pretty hard. I think this was back in, it was early on in the pandemic, maybe spring or summer of 2020.
Yes.
But there you are. You survived. Are you beginning to see some light at the end of the tunnel?
You know what? We really are. I will say it was a collaborative effort on the part of the, we are an entity in the city, but we are not a city entity. I should put it that way. The city really was dedicated to making this entity sustainable and working. And Paul Bowles and I and all of the whole team, we all worked on grants furiously, Kathy Atkins, all these, like, at the grassroots level, everyone, the city came together and, like, just worked on grants and made this work. Because, again, our big brother venue, Appalachian Wireless Arena, you know, we start with zero in July 1, and we earn it. We work for it. And I kept saying to my team, I said, guys, two P's, pivot proactively. And so we just, like, don't tell creative people that they can't put on art. It's like, well, we'll pivot. So what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. We turned a space into the art gallery, a room that was basically an ersatz rumpus room from the 70s, a junk room. We made it a gallery, and now it is functional. We are housing art through next March. We have all exhibits up in there. And
well, my colleague Sam Dick just did an interview with Jacqueline Pitts at the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce about attracting more people from other areas to Kentucky. And we've also lost a lot of population. She had data about that to communities that have made the kinds of efforts that you're making there in Pikeville to really enliven the local culture and the arts and make it a place that's exciting to live. And it sounds to me as though that's the trajectory Pikeville might be on.
Oh, I certainly hope so, and I believe so. And we're working on a creative strategic plan with Brushy Fork. The leadership in town is very dedicated to thinking outside of the box, being proactive, focusing on education and people. And look, I am not from here. I'm not from Appalachia. You can hear I talk funny. I'm a northerner. But when you see these mountains, when you drive these roads, it's breathtaking beauty. It's truly breathtaking beauty.
It is.
And people, everyone, to a person, everyone gets here and they're like, where am I? What have I happened upon? Mm-hmm. And it's just delightful that we have to have stuff. We have to have programming. We have to have trails and the whole region. We have to think regionally. We have to think macro, not micro. And I know that's a challenge sometimes, but it's for the greater good. Pull the boat in the same direction.
Well, Robin, by now, you certainly are an honorary Kentuckian.
I like being that. I love being an honorary Kentuckian.
Well, it's good work that you're doing, and we appreciate it. And everybody, that's Robin Irwin. She's the executive director of the Appalachian Center for the Arts in Pikeville, affectionately known as the App.
Thank you, Tom.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Spencer Shook, intern, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, and you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and much more. And you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter featuring a preview of the next edition. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.